begin our journey into the third mansion, the defeat of reason and the arid presence of God. Your third mansion is where you will encounter, where you have to encounter, the greatest obstacle to your journey in the soul, which is your own passionate love of reason, your mind, your own incredible love affair with logic, order, and the God that goes with that, the God behind the scenes of your mind. So before we go deeper into the context of the third mansion, let's go in soul first. Take a deep breath. I cross the bridge into the silent bliss of my interior castle, entering now into my third mansion. I close the drawbridge and forbid all outside influences from entry into this holy place that is my soul. Here in my castle, deep in my third mansion, I am alone with God. Under God's light and companionship, I discover the depth and beauty of my soul. I embrace the power of prayer. I open myself to divine guidance and I surrender myself to become a channel for grace, healing, and service as God directs my life in this world. Amen. Feel the depth and grace of the third mansion. And even as you feel that depth and grace, you can feel the presence of your mind. You can feel that strong mental nature, the strong part of you that has been sculpted by traditions that come from the age of reason, that come from a passionate need to know what's in this for me. And I have to understand why things happen as they do. I simply have to. Why they happen as they do and what's going to happen next. I need to know this in terms of guidance. I will not follow any guidance without first knowing how it's going to turn out. Because without knowing that, I'm going nowhere and I will be embarrassed and humiliated. I might fail and it might, above all else, cost me my money and security. And that is the bottom line. More than anything else, I am not going broke on this so-called alleged spiritual journey. It is not going to happen. So I may pray for guidance, but it better not cost me. And that is a very real challenge. Even back 400 years ago, before the age of reason got up and running, Teresa battled reason with her nuns, who were far more comfortable in the realm of the soul, far more comfortable. For them, as I said earlier, the soul was not an entity that was a foreign object or a force that was just sort of around to reap the benefits of a life well lived or not. They were far more accustomed to it. We, on the other hand, don't really quite know what to do with the soul. All we know is we come from a tradition where we've created a theology that is very practical minded. We have a very practical God in mind. And we expect practical responses from our prayers. Absolutely we do. Does this prayer work? Does it? Because I've had people say to me, does this prayer work? Because I've said this prayer for days and nothing's happening. Exactly what did you expect to happen? Well, I expected what? To get my way. Entitlement. To get what I wanted. I expected everything I wanted to be exactly the way I wanted it to be. Why? Because I did this with reason and good intention. What are the reasons? What is the scope and source of reason behind the image of God that you carry? Because you have an image of God. You have a holy postcard God in your wallet. Make no mistake. You absolutely do. I met this gentleman once who had an accident. And in the accident, he broke his left hip in odd and end parts of his body. And it would require, he had a car accident. It required quite a long journey of recovery and pins and needles and surgery. And in the conversation about this, this person said to me, I'm sure God has a reason for why this happened to me. And I said, why? Maybe it just happened. Why does God have to have a reason? And why does it have to be a benevolent, magnificent, incredible one? Because it happened to you. Tell me that. To which this person said, well, because I survived. I mean, there has to be a reason because I survived. And I said, maybe it happened to you because you weren't watching where you were going. That could be the reason why you had this accident. Maybe you simply weren't watching where you were going. And number two, why do you think that surviving an accident equals the beginning of a whole new chapter of your life that has to include a reward for living through an accident? It must mean a whole new incredible rebirth, second life, rewards, bells, a visionary life because you were saved from an automobile. Where do you get that thinking? Well, it's logical. Whose logic? Mine? I've been saved, otherwise God would have taken me. So I must be so important that there must be something of great reward. So let me understand this. You're getting rewarded for surviving an accident when you didn't watch where you were going. Is that the picture you've got here? Is that what you're saying to me? By this time, this person and I were on a collision course. And I said, maybe there is no great high reason. Maybe you simply weren't watching where you were going. It's an accident. No, well, these things happen. To which this person said, I cannot deal with that. This person had to have a God who had a great cosmic reason for why he survived this accident. And that reason had to include a much more incredible life that proved how special he was, otherwise he would have been taken in that accident. Now, when Teresa or any great spiritual mystic of any tradition, East or West, speaks about humility, this is what they're talking about. This is arrogance of the highest spiritual order. To think that the whole cosmos, that first of all, you should be rewarded for surviving something, that survival is not reward enough, is first of all, to think in terms of reward is just overwhelming, but that's how we think. Because we have a God based upon expectations, and we expect a lot, and it better be delivered. Absolutely. And in our world, with our God, in this fictitious creation that we have, this God of ours better attend to a very practical schedule of productivity. And it better produce. And it better be high-end production. And it better be showy, glamorous, and a lot of money at the end of whatever endeavor this God gets us into. Oh, we're not going. Because this is the God of a puritanical culture. So you say something like, I'm going into an interior life, and someone will say, what's that for? I remember when I was going into graduate school for theology, and people would say, not a lot, but a few people said, what are you doing that for? I mean, someone with your brain's intelligence, you should go for an MBA or you should go to law school. What are you going into theology for? What are you going to do with it? Translated, how will that convert to money? How does that degree convert to money? Let me think. Because the very idea that you would be following interior guidance, I didn't talk like that at the time, mind you. I didn't speak that way at the time. But looking back, that's exactly what I was doing. I was wired for this from day one. But the very idea that you would do something in this culture that in the moment didn't look financially practical strikes people as being the most preposterous thing. And how are you going to support yourself if you do this? Because I can't see where it's going to come from. Are you crazy? And with any luck, you are. You think this is a sane world? What's your measure of sanity in this world? What? I mean, if you look around, you think, excuse me, but what is the measure of sanity? Is it a paycheck? Is the bigger the paycheck the measure of sanity? Is that it? Because if you're going to have to help me out here, is how many divorces or how many divorces you have the measure of sanity? I don't know. What is the measure of sanity? How many times you go to analysis? Is that sanity? I don't know. You tell me what the measure of a sane person is in this culture. I don't know whether or not you've had an abusive childhood and can cope with it. I don't know. What is the measure of a sane person? How about someone who has the guts to follow their interior life? Maybe that's the measure of a sane person. I don't know. But I do know that that's going to be your biggest obstacle. And it's because you yourself are addicted to reason. You are. Not only are you going to have to contend with your addiction to having other people approve of you, which is big. It's great big huge. You're going to have to deal with your absolute, complete, interior secret portrait of a God that you have high expectations of. That you need to own. A God that you expect this from. What kind of life do you expect? What kind of expectations do you have? What kind of demands do you have? Because you have them, whether or not you care to admit it, but you're going to admit it now. You absolutely are. Because that's what this mansion is about. The defeat of the power of reason. And the need to have reasons for absolutely everything. Because this is your competition with God. When you go into your inner life and you pray for guidance, you hear guidance instantly. Don't kid yourself. Above all, don't kid yourself. You could tell someone else, I just don't know what to do, but don't lie to yourself anymore. You know exactly what guidance is. What do you think guidance feels like? You get a hit right away. What do you think? You're expecting a vision, a beatific vision right in front of you? Don't be ridiculous. Guidance comes through your gut. Guidance comes through stress. Guidance comes through migraines. It's the relentless voice within. It's the nausea in your stomach. It'll take any route it can get your attention. It is absolutely harsh, relentless force that makes you feel miserable. Don't go glamorizing intuitive guidance. It's instantaneous, and then you work to bury it when you don't like it. But you always hear it. feel it, perceive it, sense it. And the rest of the time you spend burying it like a corpse in the backyard. Because you don't like what you've heard. You don't like what it feels like. So never act as though you haven't heard it. What you always want is proof of how things will work out if you take the course, if you follow your instructions. What paralyzes you is your inability to act out of faith. And that has you in complete paralysis. And so you deny that you actually hear the guidance, and you go nowhere. And you begin to act in acts of self-betrayal. And that becomes your lifestyle. And when you look at the pain and suffering in the world, your personal interior world, I will tell you that on average, if you can measure it at all, 35% of pain is from the course of life, the loss of our beloved family members and friends, and from situations and circumstances that are brought about through life. We can't help. They come into life. It is life itself. But the other 60% on average comes from acts of self-betrayal. The great suffering in your life is from self-betrayal. Because you have set up yourself to live an intuitive spiritual life. But you cannot seem to defeat the power of reason. You simply can't do it. You cannot cross over that bridge and get yourself to act spontaneously in response to the guidance that goes directly into you as a result of prayer, as a result of a deeper perception, as a result of coming from your soul. You simply can't do it. You find that your reason instantly takes over, and you'll perceive something, and you'll start saying, well, maybe it's this, maybe it's that. You'll go into denial. You'll go into anger. You'll go into any number of different places, so long as you don't have to act instantly. This is the defeat of reason that confronts you in this particular mansion. And it is an arduous journey. It took Teresa years to get through this, because it is such a force. The other side of it is you need reason, but you need it within the context of discernment, to become discerning. More than reason in the self-serving sense. I need reasons for this because this or that, because of who I am and because I was hurt or because I'm frightened. That's not a good enough level. Discernment is to use your capacity to reason for safe passage, for clear passage, for wise passage. Not to stop you from following guidance, but to aid you to follow guidance. To use discernment. Reason is an asset, unless you come from fear on the spiritual path and it becomes a liability. The reasonable mind would deny the mystical experience and the mystical life. You see, a mystical experience is everything the mind cannot comprehend. It is exactly the opposite of the mind. Whereas the mind has everything locked in to the five senses. Teresa, as she wrote about one of her mystical experiences, she said, my mind wanted to come with. My eyes wanted to come with. My ears wanted to come with, but they couldn't make the journey. I had to leave them behind. the reasonable, rational mind simply cannot comprehend the nature of God. When someone strives to intellectualize the divine, what they're really doing is trying to control the chaotic, random nature of God. What they're saying is, this is the way God is. What they're hoping for is, this is the way God behaves. By defining the characteristics of God, they're hoping to contain divine experience within those behavioral patterns so that the bottom doesn't fall out of their life, so that their house doesn't fall down, so that their life suddenly doesn't get caught up in a wind of chaos, when in fact, the greatest truth we can say about the nature of the divine is that it is undefinable. It is a mystery. Everything about God is a mystery. And what the mystical journey is the capacity to enter that mystery and leave our rational mind at the door of the fourth mansion where you are going next. But in order to proceed to that mansion, in this one, you dismantle that rational, reasonable part of yourself. And this is going to take work. Make no mistake. You're going to have to come into this mansion many times and set up many of your own rooms where you have to go in and say, I've done it again. I am completely anguishing because I want a reason for why this person did this, said this, wore this. Why wasn't I invited here? Why can't I know this? Why can't I know what this is about, that is about? Reason, reason, reason. And at this point, reason collides with intuition. What should you follow? How do I follow my gut? What does it feel like? What should I expect? How do I know if God's talking to me? You're going to have all these questions. And the mind is going to want to produce just the right answers. How do you know, for example, if you enter into your castle? I mean, really, should you follow the rules? Should you go follow the rooms one by one? Which one's in order? Exactly which one should you go to just to do it right? To do it right for what? So I could have a mystical experience. When should I expect that mystical experience? And what should it be like? And what should it feel like? And how would I know? I mean, would I know, like, am I going to have an apparition? What will it look like? I mean, what would it happen? Can I have a miracle? Will I be able to, like, do things differently? Will I be able to be, like, incredible? Or do I enter the castle and do I listen to my soul say, today we need to progress to the second mansion. Today we need to progress to the first. Today this is where we belong. And you follow the course of your soul that day. And the soul says, I think we need to carve another room today. I think this room belongs in the third mansion because you are simply unreasonable. And you're unreasonable about what? What do you become unreasonable about? You're going to find out. I'm going to take you into that room. The many, many struggles with reason that exist in you are so extreme. But imagine, just for a moment, that you really could say to yourself, stop it. Turn that off. Just turn it off. If that incredible part of yourself that said, I'm sorry, but I have to know why I'm doing this. And I want you to imagine this scenario. I want you to imagine that someone, a best friend, said to you, listen, give me the keys to your house for the weekend. And this friend knows your house needs a lot of work that weekend. And this friend was going to come in and take care of a lot of things. He had hired a whole crew to come in and clean the place, clean out the cabinets, clean the windows, move the refrigerator, clean behind refrigerators. We are talking a crew and painters and rug shampooers and people to scrub down the shower stalls. We're talking ceiling to floor to take care of this person. And this was one person who should have been trusted. But instead, this person said, "Why?" And this other individual said, "What do you mean, why? How could you not trust me? How could you not trust me? Give me the keys to your place. It's even me sending you away for the weekend to a place that you love with people you love, and you're still asking me why?" Well, all right, I'm going, only to find out that this person called someone to find out why this individual wanted the keys to her home. And she pumped and pumped this person until the individual was psychically exhausted from her battering and finally said, "This is what this individual is doing for you." And the whole thing was an assault after that. So instead of her coming home and seeing everything was taken care of, she in fact became an obstacle. "I don't want you cleaning that. I don't want you moving that. Why are you doing this? This is too much money. Why are you doing this?" When in fact it was a gift being given with love. She became an obstacle. "Why are you doing this? I don't want you to do this." And it broke a heart. Now, I want you to think about that as a cosmic drama for yourself. That when you're given guidance without a reason, it's because you are the worst obstacle in your own life. You are that obstacle. To continue to say, "I need reasons to know why I have to follow this," is because you are the person most likely to destroy the plans in your own life. Because if anybody is an expert on being afraid of your life, it's you. And you will destroy your life if given half a chance because you're afraid of it. You're afraid of your own life. And so given half a chance, you will always make the most frightened choice. You always make the most insecure choice and rarely the courageous one. So it's better if you don't know the greater plans. And if you simply operated on the minimal guidance, otherwise you do the maximum of damage. And that's what's true. So now, with that wisdom in mind, let's go down the corridor. Down the corridor of reason. This is a very logical place, this one. It's all squares. It's all neat. And you open the door on the right and you walk in and it looks like a library. Very orderly. The reasonable part of you, it loves this room. The mind loves it. This is the room of law and order and your love of law and order. God represents disorder and God represents order. But surrender represents disorder. A part of you has a relationship with God that is based on the maintenance of order, of law and order. And you will only go so far with the divine that maintains law and order in your life. And in this room, dialogue with your soul about These are the areas in my life where law and order must be maintained at all cost, and it is not negotiable. There is no way that I will let this part of my life fall apart. Perhaps it's family. Perhaps it's your marriage. Here is where you are not willing to put this area of your life in jeopardy. It has to have logic, reason, so that you feel you can protect it. Law and order. And what area of your life do you simply need logical reasons? I need reasons for what? I need to know why things happen as they do, where? In my relationship. Now think. To keep things at the level of logic holds them close to the earth and prevents them and prevents you from entering into the higher altitudes of mysticism, where in fact you enter into the mystery of perception, where there is no logic. There's no logic to a miracle. There's no logic to an instant healing. There's no logic to a moment of quietude or a rapturous bliss. There's no logic to that. There's no logic to channeling grace. There's no logic to intuiting someone calling you where you feel their presence in your soul and they are 10,000 miles away. There's no logic to that. And yet a soul with stamina can do that. There's no logic. There is no reason you can do that if you look at the laws of reason. What you need to look at in here is your struggle with law and order, and how you look at parts of your life that you realize, I'm sorry, God, I cannot lose control over this part of my life. And there are many times you're going to come into this room and you're going to say, I can't release this. I can't surrender this. I cannot surrender my finances. I must have control over my physical world. That's all there's to it. And if you tell me that I have to leave my job, I won't listen to you. I will act as if I cannot hear you. Because that's too much for me. That is too much for me. I simply won't do it. That's too much disorder, and I must have order in my occupation. I must have order with my guidance. My guidance must come through and it must include outcome. I need to know how things are going to work out. I need my guidance to have a middle, a beginning, and an end. I do not like spontaneous, sporadic guidance that does not include a pension plan. This is a room where you struggle with what's true. And you recognize, I don't have any faith at all. This is where you own, I have a myth about God. I have a myth. It's just an idea. There is no force of God truly in my soul. Because if there was, I would have no struggle whatsoever. None. And the day that you can leave this room with no book on the shelf, nothing left in this room, is the day you are fully in surrender. So as you prepare to leave this room, you take a deep and sacred breath fully within you and you say, Dear Lord, I want to surrender. I want to. That prayer is so sincere. I will get there. I will get there. If only to begin that I surrender to you fully my fear of beginning this journey. Amen. Now we continue to walk down the corridor. And on the left, there is a door. I want you to open this beautiful door. It's a beautiful door. It's a wooden door. Open it up. And inside, it's a small room, a cubicle, but it's enchanting. It's just enchanting. Someone's waiting for you. It's as if God knew you were coming. There's holy water present and holy ash. The fragrance of roses is present. And there is a letter, and the letter reads, "What are your expectations of me? What are your expectations of me? You are filled with expectations. How is it that you see me, that you truly hold me in your mind? You have expectations, and you are filled with them. This is your room for you to excavate your mental expectations of God, the ones that bring you anguish, the ones you battle, the superstitious ones. Not the ones you would like to believe, that if I asked you about in a classroom, you would answer so not to embarrass yourself. But the ones you really, really do have. God is a father. God is a man. Who's your daddy in the sky? God is a rescuer. God owes me a good life. That's my expectation. I expect all my prayers to be answered. I expect, you put that down in this room. I expect everything taken care of, but I don't need to work hard at my spiritual life. I expect that if I do a 9-day novena, my prayers will be answered. Classic Catholic. I expect. What is this image of the divine you carry? God is a man, actually. God is a goddess. God has no sex. Get out of that one. Where are you with this? Are you someone who would fight to the death for your image, for your mental images, so strongly that you would hold on to what's in your mind about the divine, so you wouldn't let it melt away, allowing a greater mystery to come through, a greater, far deeper, much greater mystery. Where are you with the divine? This is your room for, I have expectations of you. When you are ever in need of prayer, of something in your life, of healing, and you will be so many times, you come in here and say, I am entering deeply into prayer. I do not want expectations. I need to trust. And I release expectations. I cannot be burdened with expectations. I surrender them to you. Every time an expectation comes up, I will release it. I trust in the outcome. However, each day unfolds from the moment I utter this prayer, I will look for you in the details. That is my living theology. As a mystic in this world, I will see you in the details each moment of my life. That is where you can expect me. And with that, take a deep breath. Amen. Continuing down the Hall of Reason, There is a huge door, huge, right in front of you. I want you to push it open. Looks like a mechanic's shop. It's got books and objects and all sorts of things and a huge desk. Go sit down at that desk. And on this desk, as you open the letter, you have a notepad there. In a dialogue with your soul, you're going to enter deeply into your soul, exploring this profound perception that entered into the human collective 50 years ago that has shaped you. A perception that was never, ever a part of human evolution before. The perception that you create your own reality. Never before was that perception ever allowed within the collective unconscious of the human species. It was given as an indicator that a new thought, a new level of inner empowerment was about to begin. This thought, this perception, has been within you for a long time. Do you create your own reality, or does God? Who's in charge of your reality? And what thought forms and attitudes form the basis of the world you live in? This is your reality shop. This is the room you come to when you know it is time for attitudes, belief patterns, memories to be shed, whose time has come to be excavated from your life, from your soul. Thought forms, patterns, all forms of interior reptiles that no longer serve you, superstitions, any form of inner mechanism that you know no longer serves you and is an obstacle in your inner path and in your inner work. This is that room. This is a room where you have to spend a great deal of time because so much of your interior world, your relationship to God, is in this room. Who is God? Your construct of God is on a shelf in this room. Where does God come from? Well, partly my childhood, partly some of the books you read, partly what? Some of the posters you've seen. Those pieces are in here. This is a room that has attitudes that you know do not serve you, and yet you continue to nurture them. This is a room that has fears that you know you don't need, but they're in here. And each of these is an obstacle. Some that you want to maintain, that need to be excavated from you. A great deal of work needs to be done in this room. There is a shelf in this room of special interest, and there will come a time when it may be of particular interest, and it has to do with your health. This is a room that you would come to should you need assistance in healing, because the rational mind is an obstacle to healing. The rational mind will say, this cannot be healed. The rational mind, when confronted with certain illnesses, will tell you that this runs in the family. What are you doing? Will tell you, modern science can't do a thing. Will tell you, oh, this may be just a matter of time. Time is five sensory. But for the mystic, for someone who knows grace, for someone who knows what it is to heal, for someone who knows how to enter into the mystery of God and transcend the limitation of the rational mind, for this person, healing anything is possible. Anything. What it requires is that you release your allegiance to the thoughts that say it cannot be done. You find that shelf in this room and you get those books out. That's all you need to do. That's it. And you have unrelenting faith. And you feel yourself sitting down and saying, that's it. All those books are gone. All those books are gone. There's a special room in your castle that is only for healing. And I will take you there. But in this room, you must confront the obstacles in your mind that stand in the way of grace, that say it cannot be done. This is that room. Become a channel for grace. Think of all that you can offer by tossing those books out. Take a deep breath. And remember this room, you're going to need to return many times. It is a powerful, powerful room, an ally, a great presence within you. Amen. In this mansion, Teresa was very clear. You would experience what she called the arid presence of God, the absence of God. John of the Cross, her beloved spiritual companion, called the dark night of the soul. Although the dark night is certainly a very specific experience of the breakdown of the senses in a progressive way. But Teresa was absolutely clear that as you go into your interior life, you will feel like you're going after nothing at some point. And the wonder of knowing this is knowing, are you at the nothing stage yet? Yeah, I'm there. That you are deeply in it by knowing I'm at the nothing stage. You at the nothing, and see if you can continue to go through it. But to understand, what is the aridness about? What is that desert? What is the 40 days in the desert about? What was John of the Cross doing under the stairs at the Dominicans in the latrine in prison for 9 months? What is abandonment by the divine about? What is that about? Why do we have to go through that? Mother Teresa, not Teresa, not my Teresa, but Mother Teresa, would say to her nuns, pray for my conversion. That's what she said to her nuns in India all the time. Pray for my conversion. She always felt that she didn't have any faith and couldn't feel the presence of God. Teresa of Lisieux, Saint Teresa, Teresa of the Roses. This mystic prayed to understand those who did not have faith, and she spent the rest of her life in a faith crisis. The irony of saying, I have never loved you more and I don't feel you at all. The arid presence of God. Part of the journey of becoming a soul with stamina is carrying the soul of another person. Is learning to carry the energy of another person without them knowing, or being given the soul of another person to carry. I've wondered when I learned about Mother Teresa always saying, pray for my conversion. I've thought that to be starving and to be poor could drive a person, perhaps, to acts of violence or to acts of such despair that maybe what she took on in her soul and its capacity to pray was their despair. Maybe what God gave her was their doubt to pray through her. Maybe that's what went through her. So what she felt was not her doubt, but theirs. Not her despair, but theirs. That's the size of a cosmic soul. I've heard and read stories of great avatars from the Hindu culture, holy men, one of his devotees was with his master who had cancer. And he said to him, how can you have cancer? How can you, such a great soul, have cancer? And he said, this isn't my cancer. And he healed himself instantly in front of him. He said, this is me. He says, this is their cancer. The evolution of we as individuals is to eventually carry each other. And part of that carrying each other begins with praying for each other. In silence, and never even saying anything, but truly putting aside, devoting a period of time in your life, every day, to send grace into this world for all of humanity, because we are all of humanity. And that part of the arid presence of God may be the experience of the aridness of humanity being given to you to see, what are you going to do with this? It could be your first test. What are you going to do with this? Can you carry it or not? Can you pray your way through this or not? The arid presence might well be the beginning of your test of carrying the weight of another person. Carrying the weight of a deeper you. And of finding whether you can wait for God on the divine's terms and not on God through the mind. People will say to me all the time, I just don't know. I don't have a direction. Do you know how many times people have said, I just don't know what to do. My life isn't going left or right or up or down, and I'm confused, and I've been waiting and nothing's happening. Because they must have a reasonable life. And they must have their life in order. And it must flow sequentially. And it must be logical. and orderly and well known to them. The unknown is too much. And yet therein lies God. And they can't see the divine as soon as they're not distracted. They crack. They can't take a half hour in silence. A half hour. In this mansion, you will enter into the desert. If you ask how long, then go into the room for law and order and say, it started. I'm already asking how long you're going to put me here, and what should I take, and what should I have? You don't get that information. You're there till you're not there. That's your answer. You're there till you're cooked. Now let's go meet God down in the corridor of the arid nature of the divine. You're walking down a corridor, and beneath your feet is sand, and you feel the dryness, and it's hot. It's very hot. And you feel the dryness of the desert, and you feel the heat burning on you. And the corridor expands wide, wide open, and what it feels like to you is as if the whole expanse of the desert has become the face of the moon. And the face of the moon has become the expanse of the desert. And there is no one that you can see for miles. You are in your inner landscape, not your outer, your inner. And there is no one in your inner landscape, but you. And as you walk in this inner landscape, to your right, a room appears that looks like an adobe. I want you to turn and walk into that adobe. As you walk in there, the fragrance of the earth comes up. And there are candles lit. And I want you to go sit down at a wooden table. And there's a letter. And you open it up. And the soul says, let us, you and I, dialogue about your feeling of fear of living a life in which your journey into the soul would cause you to be so different from everybody else. And it would make you isolated from the world you know. And how it would separate you from everything familiar. And how that would make you feel so very different. Could you take that? Do you have the stamina to become someone else? Do you have the stamina to give up who you are? To shed your skin like a snake in the desert? This is a shedding time. This is a place of dialogue and prayer with God. A place of saying, I can feel that I'm losing contact with my world. I can feel that I'm losing contact with you. I feel directionless. I feel I'm losing contact with my life. I don't know what to do or where to go. There's nothing on my landscape. I have to remind myself that this landscape is you. And that what I'm afraid of when I have this fear is my own survival. I'm afraid of my own survival, and that means I'm afraid of money, and I'm afraid of mortgage, and I'm afraid of being alone. I have to state what these fears are, and I am afraid of you not manifesting things for my protection. I have to say in this room what I am afraid of. When I get confused, I can't see my way to get the stuff I need. And so when I'm in this arid place, that's what I'm afraid of. And if I take it further, I'm afraid that I can't find you. What if you're asking me a much deeper question? What if you're asking me to become a much more invisible person? What if you're asking me to carry prayers for someone else? What if that's part of this experience of coming to know who I am in the desert? What if I have no idea who I really am? And that journey begins here. With that in mind, accept that journey and say, I shed my skin. I don't know who I am. But I give permission. I'll let that person, I'll let that soul come through. This is a room for you to let that grace come into you and spend a moment with the divine, accepting grace on behalf of others as well as yourself. And now, take a deep breath and feel yourself leaving that room as you say, Amen. Your long and difficult work with reason and with waiting for God is worth it, because the next mansion is the fourth, ascension to the cosmic level, ascension to the mystical state. In this mansion, Teresa says, God comes for you. So all the work that you do in the third mansion, and the many times you come back to this mansion, and the second and the first, which are your rigorous mansions, make no mistake, is well worth it. With that in mind, the exit prayer for this mansion. I am a channel of grace. As I leave the third mansion, as I leave my castle, grace surrounds me and protects me. I enter my life in the world under the blessing of God, within the grace of my castle, and I remain open to receive guidance from my soul. I am a channel for grace.